přece.
Can Radha tell us some more where the perception of Brahman takes place? Is it an experience or not? That's a good question. Okay. Actually, when we're talking about gaining knowledge, gaining self-knowledge, just saying positive, as though we're gaining something, in a way that's incorrect. What we're actually doing is removing ignorance. It's called ajnana nivritti. There's a subtle difference there. Because the experience of the self, not any type of objectifiable experience, but just because the self is consciousness, it's self-evident. So it is its own experience. It doesn't require a means of knowledge to illuminate at all. Like, I require my eyes to illuminate, to become aware of this room, for instance. This room is not self-evident. It requires my eyes, and backed by my mind, backed by my consciousness, actually, you know, to be able to know this. It's not shining of its own accord. The self, as consciousness itself, is shining of its own accord, so it is self-evident. So that if you remove the whole creation, all subject-object duality, me, the conscious being that I am, would still be its own experience without any duality. It requires no duality. It's just consciousness itself. And so it's not in gaining self-knowledge, it's not going to be the gain of a new experience. It's going to be the removal of the self-ignorance which causes the mind to take itself to be me. So the self-ignorance is causing what we call this mutual superimposition, anyonya adhyasa in Sanskrit. So because of self-ignorance and because the mind is not away from the self, like the pot's not away from the clay, the mind, having self-ignorance, has really, if you think about it, has no reason not to take the consciousness to belong to itself. Because wherever the mind is, whatever the mind is thinking or feeling, etc., consciousness is there. So for the mind, consciousness is a constant. I am a constant. So why shouldn't the mind, because it's whenever the mind is there, I am there. So why shouldn't the mind take itself to be me, and me to be itself? So from the mind standpoint, whenever I am there, consciousness is, right? So when I am there, consciousness is. It doesn't know anything when I am not, like in deep sleep, it doesn't have any kind of cognition. So it can't say, when I am there, consciousness is. When I am there, it'll just say, well, of course, when I'm there, consciousness is not, because of the ajnanam. But from the ajnanam standpoint, the standpoint of consciousness, when the mind is there, when the thought is there, I am. When the thought is gone, I still am. That's what is unknown, because no viveka. And so the Upanishads are holding up a teaching methodology. The Upanishads themselves are like a pramana. They're like a means of knowledge that is taking the mind step by step by step to recognize the truth of its relationship with the self, which is one of satyam mitya, where the self is the adhishtana. What is actually there, the adhishtana, is that which is actually there in truth, in fact. And the mitya is that which depends on the adhishtana for its being. So rope snake, clay pot are the good examples for that. So I am what is actually here, and the mind is what is mitya, enjoying my being completely and having no independent being of its own. Don't really understand the mitya, satya mitya relationship. The rope snake is good. Both clay pot and rope snake are excellent illustrations. They've kind of stood the test of time. But say if you think of the snake imagined on the rope, if I were to remove the rope, there's no way that the snake will stay. Right? Because really, the only thing that is there is the rope. The snake has no substance, no being of its own. It depends totally on the rope. And it's the same with the clay pot. If I remove the clay from the pot, there's no pot at all. Because in reality, there's nothing there but clay. And so here in my relationship to the mind, from the standpoint of the mind, you know, and the standpoint of the world, it has its own what we call vyavahara, its own empirical reality, right? Because it has science and it's a shared reality that we all enjoy. But you can also say that about the dream. From within the dream, you know, there's an order to the dream, there's communication, there's a shared reality within the dream, right? Not from outside of the dream, but within the dream. Yeah. But when we, being able to stand outside the dream from the waking state, you can see the dream is mithya. The dream is totally dependent upon my being for its existence. And that's why when the dream goes away, when the alarm goes off or whatever, nothing happens, because nothing happens to me. And in fact, that's exactly the experience you have if the body dies or if the universe goes into pralaya, goes into its unmanifest condition. Nothing happens to what is actually there, which is the Satchitatma, which is myself. So that being the case, when knowledge takes place, which is really the removal of ignorance, that takes place in the mind. Because the mind is the one that has the ignorance, right? It's the mind that has ignorance of the nature of the self, and so it's the ignorance that has to be removed from the mind. And when that happens, then the mind actually can differentiate its own being, its own mindness, all the names and forms, thoughts, readies, etc., from the stability of myself, right? So it actually recognizes its own mithya nature, and it recognizes the truth of my nature, you know, not because it's aware of me. It doesn't need to be aware of me. I am the awareness itself, you know. But I now, I as myself, remain unchanging, and the thoughts, moods, emotions are continually changing. And that is evident to the mind also. It recognizes the stability of the self and the changing nature of itself. That makes sense? So it takes place in the mind. How the human being that in the whole history and still now are struggling for physical survival are meant to acquire the self-knowledge for their liberation. How the human being that in the whole history and still today, still now, are struggling for physical survival are meant to acquire the self-knowledge for their liberation. Is it their karma to be where they are and not as privileged as us who can sit here in front of you, Radha? Yeah. There's a couple of things there. First of all, I guess all human beings are struggling in one way or another for their survival, but in this particular moment in time, some human beings have much more money or much more security or a much easier life than other beings do. It's certainly not equal. And some have much more. You can look at this continuum that goes to the poorest of the poor, to the poor, to the richest of the rich, to the rich, and you're somewhere there. You know, there's the normal curve. Most of us are up here in that like 60% curve. And then we have the outliers of the very, very poor and the very, very rich. And so we would say, what causes me? Remember, each one of us has had beginningless birth, so infinite. It's beginningless, so infinite on either side. So in this particular birth, why is it that you have the situation that you have, the parents that you have, born into the area that you have, with the certain security and wealth you have or don't have? You're just the situation that you find yourself in. And even more, so that there's that, and it differs for everybody, we would say that is a direct, immediate result of your karma. And the karmas are not all from the previous life, but who you are at the last moment when you pass over from the previous life to when you leave the body completely, who you are at that moment will attract to you what we call, and again, an infinite number of karmas that belong to you that are unmanifest punya and papa, called sanchit, the sanchitta karma. It's like the file of unmanifest karmas in your account. And by karmas now, we're talking about what we call adrishtapalas, karmas that one can't see. So it's the accrued punya and papa, kind of the karmas, the results of your action on a moral level in terms of dharma. So karmas that fall into the realm of adharma accrue papa, which will give negative results to your, will manifest in negative results here and now. Those are called drishtapalas. Any type of adharma does not attract to itself anything really very positive in terms of your own sense of fullness or shanti or well-being. Whereas here and now, any karma on the side of dharma attracts in terms emotionally, in terms of your sense of well-being, something positive. It doesn't really have anything to do that may attract something nice and pleasant in the world also. But not necessarily. It has much more to do with your own sense of shanti. And so an adharmic act can get you lots of money, but it's not going to get you shanti and that sense of inner depth and inner well-being and having freedom from any type of isolation, you know, or any type of constriction. Dharma gives you that. Might give you a lot of poverty too, but it gives you inside, it gives you that, which is something much more important, is that deep shanti. So now that's on what we call drishtapala, results that are seen immediately, right? Immediately or within the immediate future. Then there are the adrishtapalas, the unseen results that we call punya and papa, where punya karmas will manifest later, usually in another birth, not necessarily the next birth either, but in another birth, it will manifest in the positive situations that would make you happy if you're a samsari and you're dependent upon that situation. If you're dependent on the world to make you happy, right, these type of karmas will produce situations that are conducive to your happiness born of desire, so to speak. For a jnani, you're not really dependent on the world providing you with a good situation in order to be happy, because the source of happiness is your own ananda. Nevertheless, it is nicer to be in a comfortable, a warm, happy situation than some really negative, hurtful situation. The papa karmas will give you situations that are meant more for dukkha, or stressful, hurtful situations. And according to the tradition, just the Vedic tradition, when the next birth, any birth on this loka, on this plane, it's called the bhuloka, in this world, is going to be comprised of, for any given jiva, approximately 50-50 between punya and papa karmas. And that's why most people, if like when Swamiji's talking about life, it's like a roller coaster ride. You know, it's never just up and here we go. And see how we all laugh. It's like, oh yeah, sure. We all know. It's not like that. It's like this, you know. That's because it's approximately like 50-50. So that being so, when you take this, your next birth, it will be based upon who you were at that moment of that you die. Because there's no free will or anything, you're just left with who you basically are as a human being, you know, in terms of your bhava, your what's important to you, your value system, all of that, just the essence of it, will attract these punya and papas for if you're going to take another birth here. Because you might, for some time, experience different higher lokas and lower lokas just to exhaust karma, where you're not accruing karma. But in this loka, in this world, you're actually accruing karma, and it's like the middle world. You're accruing karma, and you're also able to gain self-knowledge. Where in the other worlds, you're just exhausting karma, and you're not really available for self-knowledge. It's objective world, but it's more like a dream. Because you don't have free will in those worlds. You're really just, it's more like a dream world where you're just experiencing and exhausting karma up and down. Except for the highest, most subtle world, which is called Satyaloka. And in that loka, you can gain self-knowledge. And in that loka, things are very, very, very nice. It's a punya bhumi. And so you're just exhausting punya in that loka. But you can also gain self-knowledge in that loka. It's the highest loka. Very hard to get there. You have to do all kinds of tapas and upasanas and meditations. And Swamiji always say, don't bother. Get your knowledge. Get your knowledge here. You have your mumukshu. Yeah, you have your teacher, you get this knowledge here. Otherwise, you're going to have to spend the rest of your days and maybe lifetimes after that doing upasana karmas and meditations and rituals and tapas and all of that to get in all kinds of dhanam, good deeds and all of these things, plus being a dharmanishta, very committed to dharma, in order to gain the punya that would deserve. It's like winning the huge lottery to get to that highest loka. And even there, the source of ananda is only the Atma. Yeah. It's just that the world in the Satyaloka keeps you, it's always fulfilling your desires as you desire, so you get, so your mind's always, always in a shantavritti, no rub. And so you always have the ananda of your being, filling that mind. So anyway, you're going to be traveling. When you lose this body, you'll travel. You'll have accrued the karmas that will really bring you to your next life. If you maybe have exhausted some certain karmas in other lokas up and down, but eventually you'll come back to this bhuloka, and you will come back with a life that in a sense is a continuation of your last life. Like today is a continuation of yesterday, which is a continuation of the day before that. This month is a continuation of last month, this year, of last year, like that. So there's a continuation. It's just this body, then this body, then this body with its life, then this body with its life, this body with its life, and now this new body with this life. But there's a thread, because it's your sukshma sharira, you're the one who's traveling, and there is a cause-effect relationship. Just like even though the karmas in this life continue to unfold, you can see the flow. This led to this, led to this, led to this, led to this. And so when you go into the next life, that flow will continue based upon the punya and papa that you've accrued and who you are at that moment of death. I forgot the question. I hope I've been answering it. Okay. How are the human beings that in the whole history until now are struggling for physical survival are meant to acquire the self-knowledge for their liberation? So that's the first part of the question. So along this way, one assimilates experience, or you assimilate your experience. And also, as you assimilate your experience, you become much more dharmic and more dharmic and more dharmic and more dharmic, because part of the assimilation of experience is the recognition that satisfying my desires, so, my sensory desires are fine. It does give me some moment of sukha. But if I do them at the expense of dharma, it really gives me a lot of suffering. And so I learn over and over again which qualities, which type of behaviors, give me fullness, what type of attitudes. That's why if you look at all of the religions, sometimes I do this for my students at CIS. I route out the Ten Commandments and the Buddhist values and the Hindu values and any type and Jewish values where they kind of list them, I make these lists. And all the lists are basically the same, you know, because over time, everyone has assimilated what attitudes, what ways of being, what things not to do. They've assimilated through trial and error and also through revealed shastras, like that, revealed scriptures. We've definitely assimilated, though, and you, each one of us individually assimilated. And as we become more and more dharmic, it really gets to a point where what really matters is dharma, and these sensory pleasures are nothing. Nothing compared to the shanti and the depth of ananda from just following dharma. But they don't disrupt either, as long as they're within dharma. But what really matters is dharma. And dharma gives me shanti. And shanti gives me the room to have an inquiring mind. The room and the grace, it's considered Ishwara Nugraha, the grace of God, to ask the question, like, who am I? Why am I here? Who is God? Where is God? You know, is there anything about me that survives death? All of these are the questions of a mumukshu who brings these very serious questions. It's not just kind of flippant, that's an interesting idea. Let's go. Not like that. So the question is really important that I really need to know. And so this type of mind that has this type of shanti and Ishwara Nugraha has these questions. And the person who has these questions, consider grace really, but it's a grace born of all of your punya, of your commitment to dharma that evokes this grace. And then such a person who has these questions then will meet a teacher who's a legitimate teacher, not a charlatan. You know, a legitimate teacher who can respond to those questions. Say if you meet a charlatan, you know, who you come with these certain questions, you know, how can I be free? I'd like to learn how to astral travel, you know, because that would give me a lot of freedom. Then the question's really not right, you know. And, you know, could I learn to meditate? I'd like to really have meditative experiences. That's what I want, is meditative experiences. Then you can meet somebody, you'd be attracted to somebody who give meditative experiences. But when the question is really the question of a mumukshu, somebody who really wants liberation, who really wants to know who they actually are and why they're here and who is God and wants to come face to face with God, to actually have knowledge, then that person will meet a teacher. Yeah. And it can be anyone, it can be according to the Shastra, because in the first Brahma Sutra, Atatho Brahma Jignyasa. Now, therefore, the desire to know Brahman. That's a little sutra. Who can have the desire to know Brahman? You know, because in India, you know, could it be a chandala, like a dog eater? A shudra? Could a shudra, because they're, you know, their shudras are, or dog eaters are untouchables. Can an untouchable person who's considered they're outside of the caste system? We're mlechas, we're all outside of the caste system, so we're not following the rules, the cultural rules. Are we qualified to gain knowledge? What about women? Are women qualified? Because the men hold most of the, you know, the power there, in a sense. It's better there than here, but anyway, they hold a lot of the power. So can women gain it? What about young people? What about really old people? Who is an adhikari? Who is a qualified student for gaining this knowledge? And the Shastra says, and Shankara says in his commentary, the qualified student is the mumukshu. It makes no difference at all who they are. It makes no difference whether they're a man or a woman or a young person. It makes no difference if they're a brahmana or a chandala or a mlecha. It makes no difference at all. The only thing that matters is that they have that mumukshutvam. If that desire for liberation is there, then they will meet their teacher. That's the qualification. So I think that's a beautiful thing. Even in the Upanishads, you know, there are women who are like the wife of the rishi, for instance, who asks for this knowledge, and then her husband gives her all of the knowledge. There are women who are teachers, a few of them, but they're there. That's the most important part. They exist. Is it their karma to be where they are and not as privileged as us who can sit here in front of you, of me? Why you're sitting in front here is because you're a mumukshu. Your karma could be anything, you know. You could have rough karma. You could be poor. You could be rich. Look at Modi. He's very wealthy. Swamiji's his guru. He really, sorry, you know. One second. Or well, some of you are taping this anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, because they ask the opposite too, like, can a very wealthy person, you know, be a jnani? Because here they have all of this wealth and all this responsibility. Like Janaka was a great king. Can he really be a jnani? And what about all these people who are in absolute poverty? That can they be a jnani? You know, like another text we might do in our last day, if I finish this one, called Manisha Panchakam, where this chandala, this dog eater, you know, gets in the way of Shankara, as Shankara and his retinue. And Shankara saying, you know, gotcha, gotcha, go, move, move. Because if they touch him, they have to all go take a shower and everything. Because it's a saucham. And so this dog eater says, who do you want to move? Chandala says, who do you want the body to move? You know, you want this food, this body made of food to move? You know, well, who exactly do you want to move here? And asks him. And then Shankar is kind of taken aback, and he says, who are you? And he answers again in five beautiful verses. It's a really, really nice. But the dog eater himself, the chandala himself, can be a great mahatma, a great jnani. So it's not about the karmas that brought you here. It's about the antakarna, whether that mumukshutvam is there or not. If the mumukshutvam is there, also your mind can be carrying a lot of emotional baggage, a lot of various types of trauma that you have to work through. But you meet your teacher, you gain this knowledge, and all the while you're working through all of this stuff. Or you have worked through all of this stuff, all of the adharmas, all of the traumas, all of the bad things, so that your mind already has some quite a bit of shanti when you meet your teacher, and then you meet your teacher at that point. It doesn't really make any difference. In any case, whatever stuff is there inside of us, whatever traumas, whatever things, those all have to be worked out. So you can either work them out in the presence of your teacher, you know, and gain your nishta with your teacher there kind of to help you, or you've already worked it out in past lives and in part of this life, and you meet your teacher. You have less to work out. But in any case, you meet your teacher because you're a mumukshu. And if you look around and you see all the inequality in the world, there's a lot of inequality in the world. You yourself have probably been very poor at some point, maybe blind, maybe lame. You've probably been, every condition that you see, from the most wealthy and able-bodied and most physically beautiful and most athletic, to the most lame and hurt and poor, you, I'm sure, because infinite, have experienced every one of those types of birth just based on your karma. You know? So now, though, that you make it to this point of mumukshutvam, all the karmas are different. You're going out of the first portion of the Vedas, which is really meant for the samsaris, and giving them a rule book. You know, how to be in this world and fulfill my desires and live a dharmic life, to the world of the adhikari, the qualified student for the mumukshu, one who desires liberation. That's a whole different type of person, because now you're no longer, as a mumukshu, your main goal is no longer to let me get this, let me have that, so I can get happy, be happy. You've already realized that doesn't work. That's what's made you a mumukshu. So at this point, you want something else. And so now our task is very, very different. It's no longer really about samsara. It's about gaining knowledge, and it's about gaining antakarana shuddhi, that purity of mind working through the complexes and things that act as obstacles for our being able to gain knowledge. Dear Radha, what is fear an indicator of, or simply, what is fear? It's a tall order to have no fear at all, because fear, if we're talking about bodily fear, then instincts kick in. And so whether you want to have fear or not, your body will give you the signals to get out of the way or to run or do whatever is necessary to do to preserve your life. So that type of fear I'm not going to talk about, because it's going to be instinctual. We have to talk about the fear that takes place in my mind, right? And that fear, I would say, is an emotion that's related to your raga dvesha, to your likes and dislikes. And it has to do with the fear that arises when things, in your opinion, are going to go in a way that puts you in some sort of jeopardy in terms of who you are, who you want to be, you know. In terms of your security, what you need to feel safe, what you need to feel happy, what you need to feel loved, what you need to feel respected, all of these things that are important kind of issues for a human being. You know, when those are threatened, or ones that you love are threatened, like for instance, knock on everything, available, the loss of a child, the loss of a spouse, something like that, you know. Then some people, if they even could think about that, they feel so much dread and so much fear, because their well-being is so deeply tied to that family, you know, or those individuals, so deeply tied, almost, especially when it's children, it's organic. You know, and so that's also kind of instinctual. Fear will rise for that. In fact, from that, so mothers, some of my students who are mothers have even talked to me about how can I give up my worry and fear for my child? On so many levels, like it's even, you know, if we're, one of my students, her child is I guess it's in either late grammar school or early high school, something like that. And actually I have two people like this. So I know it's just natural, you know. Like, do they have enough friends? You know, are they well enough liked at school? You know, do they fit in well with everybody? Are the other children nice to my child, supporting my child? These are all concerns, and they're not little concerns, they really matter, because you want your child to, you know, not suffer. You don't want your child to suffer. And so all of these things, you know, there's fear and worry about, and it's physical. I remember once, this is so sad, but my mother gave a birthday party for my brother. One of my brothers, and he must have been 6 or 7. Nobody came to the party. Can you imagine? Nobody came, and she was so horrified. I forgot what she did. I mean, she was kind of a big family, so we all went and made it a party, as I recall. But I don't recall all the details, but my mother has told me that story. She's passed away now, but she had told me that story several times over the life, how much that meant to her, you know, how awful it was. And it's passed down through the generations because now my sister has three children. And my niece just told me the story. Kristen just told me the story. When these kids were growing up, three of them, they had to go to every birthday party. No matter what, they were going, period. Nothing to say about it. And when she told me that, I thought of my brother, you know, and how we all felt, you know, and we didn't want him to know that his friends didn't come, you know. But these are big things, you know. So how to be free of those fears, you know. And so in the end, you have to keep handing your child over to Ishwara for Bhagavan's protection. Because what else can you do? You know, you can only do so much, you know. But whatever you do, it's still not safe. It's just not. And so in the end, you have to resolve your fears into some Shraddha. Shraddha means, Shraddha, it's like faith, in Vedanta it's called faith pending your knowledge, understanding, where you have an openness to learn. But in reference to Ishwara, you have a relationship, you know, with Ishwara, and you just let the universe take care, have faith that the universe will take care of it. Ishwara will take care of it, you do your best. That doesn't mean you become okay. Not that. You do your best, but then you just hand it up to Bhagavan. And I think that's what happens with that. That's how we dissipate these fears. Fears in terms of raga, dvesha, let me get my way and all of that, let me have this because I want it. Those are stupid things. Those all go away with knowledge. It really doesn't matter if you get your way or not. It really makes no difference at all. What makes a difference is your attitude toward all of these things, you know. But some of these fears are so embodied, you know, especially the fears for your child and those that you really love. Those are like very deep fears. So. How to tell what fear is? Fear is that emotion that you feel that you call fear. And it can be just a little fear, or it can be really gripping fear. I don't know how to answer that any better. How can we handle our emotions when they arise? Do we need to know where they come from and why, or can we just be with them? We can actually, that's a good question, we can actually just be with them. And being with them means to welcome them and not be afraid of them, you know. And that itself takes away a lot of the sting of the emotion because the buddhi in welcoming those emotions is relaxed. If it's welcoming. Welcoming, if you're welcoming, you're relaxing. If you're rejecting, there's tension there because you're pushing away. If you're welcoming, then the buddhi, your mind, your intellect is relaxed. It has shanti. And then you're welcoming the emotion into that peacefulness, which itself dissipates the energy of the emotion, right? So that welcoming is really important in just being with the emotion. Then you can address the emotion as you're addressing a child or a little one or whatever it feels like. You can say something like, okay, tell me what this is really about. What's it really about? Because you might think your emotion is about somebody looked at you cross-eyed over here or this or that happened out here. You know what? It usually, that is just a trigger for some hurt that you're carrying with you inside. Something that happened when you were little or whatever. That, whatever was done out here is triggering into that deep hurt. Otherwise, it's something objective and kind of usually very handleable. But when you get those deep emotions that you have to know what to do with is usually something triggered inside. And so if you welcome them, that itself, it's like mom holding you on your lap. You know, it makes a big, big difference because there's somebody there who loves you and is willing to, is comforting you. By your welcoming the emotion and not pushing it away, that kind of comfort is given. And so then that's very healing, just that. But then also just saying something like, tell me what's really going on, what's really hurting you. And then very often, usually it's even saying, that emotion will talk to you. Your psyche will talk to you and tell you, you know. Especially if you're, you know, if you're very welcoming, then there's love and kindness there, and then it'll tell you what's really bothering. And that can be really helpful. Helpful to you because you have some objectivity toward, then you understand, you know. And it helps that emotion, dissipates even more that emotion when you put it to words, because it brings it more to consciousness. So that's, I think, the most helpful thing to do. Make sure I answered that. Yeah. We haven't reached 9:15. I'm still going strong. Okay. If it's all about following one's manuscript and acceptance of what is, how do we know when to use our free will and change our circumstances? Within the Prarabdha Karma, we can call that as a manuscript in kind of broad strokes. In broad strokes. So within the manuscript of broad strokes, there's all kinds of wiggle room, but maybe not as much as you think, you know. And so just like in this where you say, you know, we decide we want to change the script. It's really hard to change the script. You know, you can change the script within the script of your karma, you know, within the main story of your karma, you can change the script, you can do this and do that within it. But the major things of the Prarabdha change when they change. And you can be wanting them to change for a long time, but nothing happens. You know, like for instance, I've been thinking that it's time for me to quit CIS, where I work, you know, at the university where I work, for quite a while now, almost every semester. But okay, now this is really enough. This is enough. But no, for some reason I'm not able to. And it's a valid reason also. Not, okay, I'll do one more semester. You know, and it keeps going on like that. And so it's the same with my psychology practice. A lot of things I've been ready to wind up for a long time. I'm just talking about the present. But no. You know, something else, like I was thinking, because I've been trying to close my practice for a while, but I still have some clients. I can't really close it until we've finished our work. It just is how it is. So I thought, yeah, but now I only have so few clients now. I can't really afford to keep it open. You know, it's going to cost too much money to keep it open, but I kind of have to. It's just a situation. So what happens is that my next door suite mate wants my office, and I said, yeah, you can take this office if I can have it one day a week. You can have it. I'll even leave the furniture here. You can have the whole thing. Just let me have it one day a week. She said, well, that's great. And so now she has all of the expenses, and I have the expense of one day a week, and so now all is well. Now I can just keep going until, you know, my last patient is finished. So things just work out, you know. They work out. And things end when they end. Even though in your mind you're ready, Bhagavan is much slower. You know, Vyavahara, empirical reality, moves very, very slowly. And your mind can, you know, get ahead of itself. You know, I've always noticed that. And for me, I don't mind that, because I'm willing to just be really patient. And even if I'm thinking, it's time to quit, I also know at the same time, and we'll see when we actually do quit. Mm-hmm. See, just out of experience and out of knowledge, things come to an end when they come to an end. Mm-hmm. Relationships begin when they begin. Relationships end if they end when they end, you know. you don't have that much say about it. You may want, say you're in an unhappy relationship and you want it to end. It doesn't. It doesn't until it's time. You want to be in a relationship. There's nothing there. Nothing there. You want it until there is. And then it's there. You know, it's, things happen in their own time, you know. Even the development of your career, the development of your life, your children, everything. It happens in its own time. And Ishwara's time is slower, you know. Slower than your fantasies and your imaginations. And so you need to just slow down. Slow down and be with what is. In fact, for jnana and prajnani, you just are with what is, not with all this imaginal world, which is not. Right? The imaginal world is not. It's only there in your imagination. But we can spend way too much time there, living in this imaginal world in the future, and then living in the remembered world of the past, all of the things that happened in the past, the bad things of the past, the bad things that were done to you, circling around, living in that world which is not here now, and the world to come is not here now, you know? And so, what about now? So we can spend a huge amount of our life, you know, in the past and in the future, and not enjoy our life, our prarabdha, the life we've been given, which is now. And so what happens as you gain more clarity, you slow down. Your mind slows down to appreciate what you have right now. You know? Some years ago, Swamiji, I forget, it's probably about, at this point, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I was talking with Swamiji, and you know what, I was complaining about something. He said, you know, you should appreciate what you have. Try to appreciate what you have. Because what you don't have is infinite. Mm-hmm. Right? What you don't have is infinite. So what are you going to do about that, you know? Add a few more things, it's still infinite what you don't have, you know? So be here now and appreciate what you have. I really heard him then. That was really huge for me. Mm. Yeah, they say things at the right times. So, mm-hmm. And then those things really, really matter. Mm. So let's do that one. How do we know when to use our free will and change our circumstances? I think we use our free will in a way for small things and to discipline ourselves not to do some adharma or eat that extra piece of pie. The things that we have to do, you know, to keep ourselves healthy. And so we use our free will more in that way, in terms of choices between dharma and adharma. That's how we really use our free will, you know, because we can choose either way. We're put in situations to choose either way. You know, and so, as a karma yogi, we want to always choose dharma. And so that's where you can think of your free will, because you have the free will to choose adharma in the situations that present themselves. If you think you can use your free will to really, really alter your life, it's probably going a little too far, you know, in terms of changing the whole course of your prarabdha, you know. Even to make big decisions that have to do with taking a new job or quitting the job that you have or beginning some new path, you'll find that you're unable to make that decision until it's time to make the decision. You know that decision is coming, you have to make the decision. But it's not, but you can't, because it's not the right time. And when it is the right time, the decision kind of makes itself. And that's an important thing to keep realizing over and over in your experience, because after a while, when you can't make a decision, you're just not clear, then you should be telling yourself, I can't make that decision yet because I'm not clear. You have to be patient. I have to be patient. And see, when it's time to make that decision, I'll make it. It's too early now. I'm not clear. And that's perfectly fine. That's normal. You're not ready to make the decision. I would even say that, not like that. The decision is not ready to be made. It's this, because of your imagination and your foresight, you can see in the future this decision is pending. And you don't know what you're going to do, so let's make it now. Well, it's not time to make it now. So you learn how to be patient, and that's really a blessing. And then you find decisions are not the big deal that you thought they were. They actually make themselves, if you're patient, all of the chips falling into place and it becomes obvious what it is you're going to do. But that means you have to kind of live your life and not be living off in your imagination, which is a great thing and not to be taken for granted, because most of us live most of our life in an imaginal world, not here. Yeah. How do you know what is the right choice to make? If the choice involves mainly yourself and your future, it seems difficult to me to follow what is according to Dharma in this case, as it is not always clear to me what is best for me or not. Yeah, exactly. That's where you have to be patient. That's where the patience comes in, because you really don't know. You don't know. So you wait a day longer, especially as you're coming right up to it. Wait a day longer and give it a chance to reveal itself to you. That's, that's what I would suggest trying. I've never had it not work. Maybe it wouldn't work, but usually becomes, if you need to be patient. It's hard sometimes. Can you please explain the difference between Ishvara, Brahman, and Bhagavan? Ishvara means the one who has overlordship of everything. So it's kind of like saying the Lord or God is Ishvara. But say if we have a name for God, for Ishvara, then that would be Bhagavan. Bhagavan is just simply like a name, like a proper name for Ishvara. And it means the one, that Vaan affix means the one who has these bhagas. Bhaga is wealth. And so there's a sixfold wealth that Ishvara, as being in the form of this whole infinite creation, has. And so that sixfold wealth is called Aishwarya, total samagra Aishwarya, means total overlordship of everything, total power. And then Vairagya, samagra, total dispassion, Vairagya. And then Yeshas, total fame, nobody's more famous than Bhagavan. Total jnanam, total knowledge, sarvajnyatvam, and then total viryam, all strength too. So is that six? Aishwarya, Shri, all Aishwarya, Shri, all wealth, Vairagya, all dispassion, jnanam, viryam, yeshas. Yeshas is fame, viryam is all strength, capacity, all shakti. So they just have these six. You could have more than six, right? But they say this Bhagavan is the one who has this sixfold wealth. All power, all knowledge, all strength, all Shri, all wealth, all Vairagya, not needing. Vairagya means dispassion, not needing any of it, because it's all me. So all knowledge, because sarvajnyatva means omniscient. And so that becomes a name for Ishvara, for Ishvara. And what was the other one? Brahman? Yeah. Brahman is Ishvara's self. Just like we say the Atma, yourself, the truth, your innermost being is the Atma, is the self. And the Mahavakya, the knowledge that the Vedanta gives, is that your Atma, yourself, is Brahman. Brahman is the self which is infinite, the very self of Ishvara. And Ishvara is the Lord, the one who is the manifestation of the whole infinite creation. That manifestation of creation has for its adhishtana, for its being, Brahman. And so if Ishvara is the infinite creation, means all time and space, all that is, and it has for its being Brahman, Brahman must be infinite. Not in size, but in being, non-dual, as the very self of this infinite creation. And it is that very self that you are. So the Mahavakya, or the essential teaching of the essential teaching of the Upanishad, means Mahavakya, means Mahavakya, great statement. So what it, well, great statement means the essence that every Upanishad teaches you, and that is the identity between your being, the self that you are, and Brahman, the one who is the self of the whole creation. The whole teaching, moksha, is the recognition that this being that you are is the self of all beings, is the very self of Ishvara. And Ishvara itself is this whole Maya Upadhi, is Mithya by nature, so there's really nothing but Brahman. So, Brahman is the self, which is infinite, non-dual, the very self of Ishvara. Bhagavan is like a name for Ishvara. You can still say, well, let Ishvara do it. That's fine, but we will often say, let Bhagavan do it. It's more personal, more like a personal name. Like I said, let God do it, you know? Or if God has a name, you know, we say, let that name do it, you know? Yahweh do it. Yeah. Ready? We did it. We went all through this.
Swasti prajabhyav paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Deshoyam kshobarahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham svastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhavet, asato ma satkamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om